show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Bouncing ball, Moustakas, fair ball. Sets, throws, Royals win it. Kansas City, you've got a World Series.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Ladies and gentlemen, I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me is the exasperated Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
I'm going to go start some fights on Twitter.
There you go. It would not be your first, nor would it most likely be your last.
It's true.
But you're probably asking yourself, why would Michael Engel be exasperated? Well, the answer to that question, of course, as many of you probably already know or can assume at least, as Royals fans, is this has been somewhat of a hectic week, really. I should say not even a week, last 4 to 5 days of just kind of nonsense, if you will. There was all this mess at the beginning of the season. We spent a couple shows talking about it, you know, the Royals, the new bad boys of baseball and all this business. And then, you know, all the beaning other players and getting beaned and, you know, all this stupid stuff that was going on and trash talking in the media and whatnot. Everything subsided. The Royals started winning ball games and it was all good. And then we come to this past series against the Blue Jays. It felt to me like there was already some animosity going into the series. Nothing between the Royals and the Blue Jays necessarily, it seems like all of a sudden this whole Blue Jays stealing signs thing has kind of reemerged this season, caught a little bit more steam. For those who are unfamiliar, just the short breakdown. 5 years ago, ESPN did a somewhat in-depth article, actually, about some multiple organizations that were accusing the Blue Jays of stealing signs. This is back in 2011 and actually referencing the 2010 season. So it's been quite a while. But they talked about how pitchers from the opposing team at the Rogers Center in Toronto – in the bullpen were able to see a quote unquote man in white who would make certain repeated signals as the Toronto hitters started hitting well. And so they were like, what's going on here? And they kind of noticed that this person was feeding signs to the batter somehow about what pitch was coming. And so they tried to play a little game where they're like, okay, we're going to try and predict based on what the guy's doing, what the pitch is going to be to see if he's stealing the sign. We can read how he's stealing the signs. And they were able to do it. You know, they were able to crack this guy's code, who was able to crack their code apparently to find out what pitches were being called. And anyway, this was something that was, you know, asserted by multiple teams. Some were saying they knew about this man in white. Others say that they weren't. And then independent of this, there was a study done by somebody at Fangraphs who didn't even, or no, sorry, it was Baseball Prospectus, who they weren't privy to this article that ESPN was going to write. They had just kind of on their own maybe thought something was suspicious or whatever, or just that it was a statistical anomaly. And the difference in OPS and just home run totals and hitting in general for the Blue Jays from at home and on the road was well beyond, you know, not only the average deviation between the two, but then beyond even like standard deviations of that you would expect. Okay, if they're, you know, above the norm, you know, they would still be within this range, but they were just well above that. And no one could really understand or explain, you know, why there was such a difference here. And then, you know, you throw on top of that the fact that you've got players like Jose Bautista, who was just kind of a journeyman, didn't really do much. And then all of a sudden he broke out with huge power when he arrived in Toronto. Players like, you know, Chris Colabello and Edwin Encarnacion and I'm drawing a blank on who the last person I'm thinking of. But anyway, a lot of players that for Toronto who have, you know, just had kind of average hitting careers outside of there. And then all of a sudden they become these mashers in Toronto. And part of the statistical study that Baseball Prospectus guy did, and I'm sorry, I cannot remember his name, but was separating out the results of how Toronto hit. You know, theoretically, their park is actually a pitcher's park and would mm-hmm. actually be negative for hitters. So it was kind of perplexing that not only were they hitting better than you would expect based on the tenets of that discussion, but also like so far above and beyond that it's even different than, you know, lots of hitters are more comfortable at home, but mm-hmm. you know, even so, this is kind of ridiculous, and it's across the board and it's as a team and just kind of interesting. Lots of, you know, in this year, no less than four teams have accused them of stealing signs. And I don't know, you know, there's a lot of suspicious. It's just, it's fishy. It doesn't seem, you know, we talk a lot about stats on this show and we like to look at the numbers to trust what our eyes see. And what my eyes saw in that series against Toronto was it seemed like every single piece of contact was squared up perfectly.
Yep.
And, you know, there's one thing if you're a Miguel Cabrera, Mike Trout, you're a really skilled hitter, but every single hitter was hitting the ball, hitting it well, and hitting it perfectly. And usually when you can square a ball up like that, it means that you kind of, not necessarily that somebody's giving you the signs, but that you know what's coming because you predicted the pitch correctly. And it just seemed kind of odd that for four games, they were able to do this.
Six to seven guys were able to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, if they're just really good hitters and I'm, you know, overestimating or underestimating them, then, you know, more power to them. But, I mean, are you with me here, Mike, on this little staying a little fishy? I think that you are, but
the tough part is that it's circumstantial, but it definitely does bring up a big kind of red flag when it's such a disparity and consistently such a disparity where this guy's average on the road and he's Mike Trout on the road or at home. And when you take into consideration, like you said, Toronto is just independently as park factors go, it's a pitcher's park. Generally, you're going to expect runs to diminish from a neutral environment when you're in Toronto. And yet they're going out and hitting the ball hard every single time. Now, in some cases, a guy like Josh Donaldson, he really broke out a couple of years ago. Not to say that he's not a good hitter. It's not to say that Bautista, you know, isn't a good hitter. He still hits pretty well on the road. You know, Encarnacion has kind of had the lowest splits generally for many of those guys. But it's like when you do see guys like Colabello and just random guys go in there and turn into these huge mashers in this lineup, is this machine? It does bring up those questions. And in light of the question brought up back in 2010, 2011, well, I think it's easy to connect those dots. The thing about it is that the way that they were signaling, supposedly, allegedly, back in 2010, 2011, was that he would just indicate if it's a fastball or off speed, which that can be a big advantage if you know that you can just sit back and wait on the off speed pitch, or if you know you need to jump on it. So in that kind of case, that can make a big difference if you know that you're not going to have to swing off balance. You just have to look location because you know what else is coming. That can really, for a big league hitter, that can make a big difference. And so that's kind of where things started, because it seemed like anytime the Blue Jays were up, they could just explode for three or four runs just in a flash because anything was hit hard. You know, Dave Lasky wrote in his preview about Danny Duffy, about his last start, which was against Toronto, that I think it was Donaldson or Bautista, I don't remember who hit the home run, but they hit a 2-0 changeup, which Duffy has thrown now 9 out of 300 pitches in a 2-0 count. 9 of them have been changeups. And so if you're looking at that low of a percentage, how can you really look for that? That's where the question kind of comes from. There was one thing that I saw, and this is flimsy and circumstantial too. There was a in Saturday's game that the Royals won, Greg Holland was pitching to Troy Tulowitzki, and they are having a battle, and this is about 7 or 8 pitches in. He has 2 strikes on him. The pattern had pretty much been slider, fastball, fastball, slider, fastball. And so you would expect maybe another fastball would come. And Sal Perez put down 3 fingers for the slider. And as soon as they had it focused on Sal Perez, as soon as he put that down, Troy Tulowitzki stepped out of the box. And that just kind of made me, you know, that weird little kind of feeling. I don't know if that means anything. You know, I don't know. There's a certain point in all of this where stealing signs really isn't illegal. It's like if they're going to tell.
It's like counting cards in blackjack.
Yeah, it's like it's just definitely frowned upon. But in this case, it's like if you are relaying signs from outside the field, you're using somebody in the outfield when it's not somebody at like second base, because that's the main thing. Like anytime you see the catcher and the pitcher have a conference on the mound when a guy's on second, that's because they're changing up the signal so that he can't see it and somehow relay it to the batter. And so that, you know, you're mixing it up, you're changing up what your signs are going to be in the progression. And that way they can't tell what's coming. If you have a guy on first and third, they can't really see the catcher's sign. So it's not that big of a deal, but you could theoretically have a guy parked out in the outfield or somebody on a, you know, with a camera. I don't know how they do it. I mean, I don't know how it is, but I mean, there are ways to look in and see what the sign is going to be.
I mean, if they're parked, they could stick a camera with a, you know, telephoto zoom lens anywhere that would be, you know, inconspicuous and give you a perfect view of the catcher's signal.
And it's just having some way that's within their line of sight that you can see, okay, yes, no. It's a binary thing. Fastball, off speed. Yes, no. You know, if this is up, it's fastball. If this is down, it's off speed. And that can be enough. You know, in that 1 second before the pitch comes, that's can be the difference. Now, I'm sure other teams will steal signs. And a good argument is that if somebody's not going to mix it up, then that's on them. You know, if the Royals are only going 1 for fastball, 2 for curveball, and they don't change it, well, that's on them. But if you're doing it outside of an environment that's not part of the game, which is what the accusation is, then that's where it starts to get into that kind of that violation, the idea of cheating. If you know, Josh Donaldson standing on second and can see, okay, it's a slider and has some way to relay that quickly, well, then the Royals, yeah, they need to mix it up. But if he's on first and has no way to look in at the catcher, but they still get the sign, then that's where I think teams are taking the issues and where the accusations are coming from. So that's where you start with the weekend, with kind of Toronto trying to make a name for itself. They had just traded for David Price and Troy Tulowitzki. So they're basically all in and trying to get fired up. They're playing the top team in the AL, so it's amped up in Toronto. And then, you know, by the time they won 2 games and even came back and almost tied it up in that 3rd game that they lost, well, by the 4th game, that's where things started to just get crazy. That started Edinson Volquez beamed Josh Donaldson in the shoulder. Nobody on. It looked intentional. Everybody was warned. Maybe that's related to the whole sign stealing thing. I don't know. And then it just kind of progressed from there. So, you know, and
sorry, are you watching the game right now? Have it on in the background.
Yes, I am. I see a sign for a 1 hour full body massage.
Yeah. What? I'm sorry. $29.95. They literally, for people, if you didn't watch or the game on Tuesday night, they literally just zoomed in. I've got it on mute, so it doesn't pick up on this. I couldn't hear what they said, but I'm curious. They advertisement for a 1 hour full body massage with an asterisk for some reason.
My goodness.
Asterisk for $29.99. So whatever that means. Sorry to interrupt, but that was.
No, that was, now I'm checking Twitter. Yeah. Because. Wow. Wow. Yeah, I'm kind of sad that we weren't listening to that because I wonder what Hudler was saying. But anyway, back to Toronto. At a different point, Volquez lost control of a changeup, but went up and in on Donaldson. Donaldson started to chirp. You know, it was if you're trying to hit a guy, it's not going to be on a changeup. It's just not. That's just not how it works. If you're trying to send that message, you're going to do something that you know you're going to hit the guy. Later on, Ryan Madsen ended up hitting Troy Tulowitzki on the back elbow, but Tulowitzki was hanging over the plate. His arms were literally over the box. I mean, it's tough, you know, to pitch to a guy inside when he's doing that, but you still have to pitch inside. So neither of those really looked intentional. And to the umpire's credit, Jim Wolf, he didn't deem them as intentional pitches inside or an intentional beanball on Troy Tulowitzki. And so even though there were warnings, nobody was ejected. And so I think that got Toronto ticked off. And so later on in the game, Escobar's leading off. They throw a pitch inside after looking into the dugout. And then on the next pitch, he gets hit again. Or they throw inside again and he gets hit. So immediately Aaron Sanchez, the reliever, is thrown out. John Gibbons, who had already been thrown out, comes out onto the field. Everybody starts, you know, clearing the dugouts and things like that. And so then it became that whole narrative that we had to deal with in April of Royals being bad boys and, you know, all this stuff. And it's just like, I mean, Volquez, yeah, he set up the warning. He should not have hit Donaldson. And so that's inexcusable. You can't really, you know, clear that from him. That happened. Okay. But the rest, everything that happened after that, which was mostly that night, you know, that's where it kind of went crazy.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, it's
we get into the same point where, okay, so Jose Bautista tweets something about Ned Yost saying he lost respect for him because Yost was just like, I think the umpire handled it fine. That's all he said. And that's apparently worthy of losing respect for somebody.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't get it. And it's, you know, it there's one side of me that feels, well, not one side of me, but I do feel that it's actually it was kind of nice to see this because there was definitely an evolution in the way Royals handled this particular scenario versus how they handled the A's and the White Sox earlier in the season. I feel like there was a little bit more trash talking, you know, kind of and not even trash talking, but there was also that kind of persecution feeling from the Royals in how they gave answers to the press about questions about the issues with Oakland or with the White Sox or whoever. And I didn't really feel that this time. You know, there was Volquez's comment, which was that, you know, Donaldson was being a baby and he kind of was,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I can see why he was upset, but that doesn't make the way he handled being upset any more appropriate than it was because he was kind of whining a little bit.
Yeah.
And,
he was,
you know, even if he had full course to be upset, you know, talk to the umpire and be like, hey, what's your reasoning here? They just, you know, why didn't, you know, I mean, you can,
right.
You're allowed to have kind of conferences like that with the umpire. So that being said, you know, it was, they feel like they definitely handled it with a little bit more grace, except for Yordano Ventura.
Yeah.
Who, my mind, poor. He really, I'm not sure what it is, but he flew off the handle somehow. I mean, I know he was involved in the bench clearing incident, and it, you know, that was kind of it though, because he obviously didn't pitch in that game, and it was just a strange thing where he, for whatever reason, felt the need after Bautista said he lost respect for Ned Yost to attack him. Right. You know, rather viciously.
I
on
think
Twitter.
Sticking up for his manager, but yeah, I mean, he kind of burned him a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely an element of sticking up for his manager, but there was an also element of, you know, the guy at the bar who's had one too many drinks and kind of flying off a little bit,
right,
or mouthing off a little bit. And it was, you know, he called Jose Bautista a nobody, which is just,
I think Bautista homered off of him too.
Yeah. And like, I guess there was some disparity in what the possible, cause it was written in Spanish, the tweet. So there's some disparity in the possible translation. Mm-hmm. He either was saying you are a nobody or you are nothing to me type of thing. So it's like, you know, either way, he's homered off you. He's hit you well, and he is a multiple time all-star. So saying he's a nobody or he's nothing or anything, it's just dumb and it's inaccurate. And the whole thing from Ventura was dumb, and he shouldn't have, he absolutely should not have said it. And all the things that he said. And then that, of course, brings, you know, more heat towards the Royals way and more of the, you know, Yordano Ventura needs to mature. And there's not, you know, that's not entirely untrue. Yeah.
It's hard to deny it when it just keeps happening.
Yeah.
With the same guy.
Yeah. And, you know, a separate conversation maybe for a separate show is at this point with Ventura needing him to get right for the playoffs. I don't know. I am fully confident that Ventura is going to be a very good pitcher for a long time.
Yeah. But
in terms of him being ready for this season when the Royals need him, I don't know that that's going to be the case. And this kind of part of it, because I think, you know, he needs to mature. I said this the other day on Twitter. I was like, Yordano Ventura needs to mature, or he's got a lot of maturing to do to get to the point where the Royals need him to be, and by the playoffs. And someone said to me, you know, yeah, man, you know, sarcastically, of course. Yeah, man, this 23-year-old should, or this early 20s kid should act like an early 30s kid or something like that. And I was like, man, you're totally missing the point, okay? Because there is definitely an off-field maturation that needs to evolve, but there's also an on-field maturation that needs to happen for Yordano Ventura, because, you know, his, like we saw the other day, he had 3 2/3 perfect innings.
He looked fantastic. Being pitched,
looking just against amazing.
Against a great lineup.
Against a very good lineup. And then he imploded and gives up, was it 3 runs that inning? 4 runs?
He gave up 5 total.
5 total. Okay, yeah. So for that, I mean, was it on that inning? It was just for the game? Or
I think he gave up like 4 that inning and 1 more.
Yeah.
I don't have the box score in front of me, you know, but it was something like that.
He looked shaky the rest of the way. So, you know, there's... What was so impressive about him last year was in all these big scenarios against all these really good hitters, it didn't matter. He was unflappable.
Yeah.
He was calm. He was composed. He looked well beyond his years in terms of how he carried himself on the mound. And you see none of that this year. You saw it a little bit in that game, those 3 2/3 inning. I was like, man, that's the guy from last year. That was the guy in game 6. That's the guy we need. And then they got one hit off him, and it was squared up, and it was a really good hit. And he was shaky after that. His body language changed. You know, the way he caught the ball, he kind of snapped at it instead of coming just right to the glove and those things. I mean, those things change, and they're, you know, sometimes those get overblown because athletes can, you know, some like James Shields, like we keep bringing that up, but it's true. You know, he was someone who was able to channel that appropriately. And those things matter when you can't channel them appropriately. And to this point, this season, Yordano Ventura has not shown that ability. So,
yeah, I think it's fair to ding him on that because he hasn't been able to deal with it in a positive way. Like Duffy's mostly been able to. Shields obviously did. And, you know, Ventura needs to learn that. And, you know, back
Volquez
to
Volquez has. And
yeah. And so it's just like, yeah, I mean, you can't sit there and say, OK, he's 24 and needs to act 30. But there are 24-year-olds who can act in a more responsible and mature way than Ventura has been doing. Just act like those guys.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to like put out the fire in him or the competitiveness or anything like that. But at a certain point, it, you know, it's something that he has to find that he doesn't want to, you know, he's got to harness it basically.
Yeah. I mean, think about Madison Bumgarner last year.
Yeah.
You know, in the World Series, all the innings he pitched,
he was fired up. But he sure wasn't shaking.
25 years old,
yeah.
You know. So this idea that, you know, just because somebody's young is an excuse to not, you know, there's no excuses. It's Major League Baseball. Dude is a professional. He has to. If you're going to be put in this position where you are an opening day number one starter, you have to act like one. And that is not to say that I'm not a stick in the mud who just doesn't, you know, the leg kick. type of thing that he did last year when he would field grounders and after strikeouts, you know, I love that. Absolutely love it.
Yeah.
You know, when he's dominating and he's rolling, he can do that. And that's great. You know, but when you're in a position where you're not having that success, then in those emotions, instead of, you know, a kind of a little flamboyant leg kick to accentuate an out or a strikeout or something, instead of that, it becomes, you know, slamming your hand in your glove or doing something to that effect, you know, then it's affecting you negatively and you need to be able to control that. So, you know, this, it's all kind of wrapped and intertwined in all this stuff that's been kind of the undertones all season. But interestingly enough, there was an Outside the Lines that aired recently. Was it yesterday?
It was yesterday. Yeah. Yeah.
Yesterday being Monday, of course.
Slow news day, maybe.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess. But the topic of the Outside the Lines segment was literally the Royals, the bad boys of baseball. Now, I didn't watch this, and because it aired while I was at work.
Yeah, it was 4:30 in the afternoon, which is tough to get to.
Yeah, and many that I heard said that it was pretty worthless and not really worth watching. Or boring was the one that I heard a lot.
Yeah.
To describe it. But you know, this whole thing, and then there was a mention on around the horn about the Royals, and I'm not sure which reporter said it, but there was one that
I'm sure it was calm and reasoned.
Yes, but it was that was said that the Royals are acting like entitled little jerks. Something that effect. That was a quote I saw on Twitter from somebody who was watching it, which is just fascinating to me that these like sports narratives are just so fascinating to me. I mean, last year it was, yeah. Oh man, these Royals, such a great story. Kansas City being good for baseball. This is so great for Major League Baseball, small market teams. We need more of this, you know?
Yeah.
8 months later, it's all these entitled little jerks.
And they're not doing that much different. Like,
and tell me, please, what the Royals, who've been to the playoffs once in the last 30 years, granted it was very successful, but once, tell me what in the world they possibly could feel entitled to right now. You know, that's what's so great about this team is, and kind of why the whole bad boys thing started, is because they didn't feel entitled. They felt the opposite. They felt like nobody was giving them anything.
And that, yeah, they needed to show teams that they weren't going to get pushed around again. You know, just like last year, they were going to win and they weren't going to just back down. This year, it was going to be the same thing. And that's kind of how the season started. But that's also like, that's, you know, what happens first in the series, you know, in any series of events, just for a lot of people is going to, it's the first impression. And so this year, the first impression of the Royals was this team that got into a lot of scrapes. And then you get 3 months where all they do is win. You know, they just win and get into all-star games. And then another thing comes up and all people remember is what happened before. They don't remember the May, June, July that pretty much nothing of incident happened. They just remember back, oh yeah, the second week of April, they got in a fight with the White Sox, and that's all it comes down to. And so that's just a national thing, I think, because, you know, the Royals are just kind of this story that keeps going and keeps going, and they kind of fade out. But then you get to the point where, okay, this comes up again, and you're immediately going to remember what happened early. And so you're like, oh, there they go again.
Yeah. And it's interesting, the way Sam Mellinger from the Kansas City Star put it, that actually, you know, kind of made sense. And because he was part of the Outside the Lines panel, I guess. But he said that, you know, the reason that he kind of did it and wanted to be a part of it was because he wanted to clarify as much as possible. He's like, people are going to make up their own opinions either way, which I, you know, I've always agreed with. But, you know, just information, you know, providing context and information about who the Royals are and where these things are coming from, because he's like, from a national perspective, you know, if you're a Phillies fan, right? Like, you hardly ever play the Royals, you know, not even every year. Don't
Why
even
would
care.
You have reason to pay attention?
You know, all you're going to see though is on SportsCenter, you saw a bunch of highlights in April about the Royals getting in all these fights. nothing, month for month, you know. And then you see yesterday, oh, Royals were in another fight. So, like, when that's all you see, even if it's months apart, then that can definitely kind of pepper the perspective a little bit and turn it into a negative one from a national perspective. So I get that. But, you know, at the same time, a lot of it is fueled by national media, mm-hmm. who should know better and who should do better research.
Right.
You know, because, like, hey, you know, if you're going to write an article about the Royals, you know, whatever, there were articles back in April written all over the place, you know, about the Royals and whatever their whatever they decided to call them at that time. But, right. you know, give Sam Ellinger a call at the KC Star, or give, you know, Vahe Gregorian, or, you know, whoever, you know, call somebody from the local scene, somebody on radio or whatever, and just be like, hey, you know, what's the deal? Why is all this happening? All this stuff.
Yeah. You know, what have you seen in the last couple months?
Yeah, it's not hard to do that. And they just didn't seem to. So that the national perspective is kind of just run away with itself about the Royals. That's just, you know, wholly inaccurate.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because, I mean, the story of this season is so much different than just guys who got into fights. I mean, it's a crazy defense. It's Lorenzo Cain's breakout. It's Eric Hosmer's just his last month of just absurdity. You know, things like that. The acquisitions that they got that nobody really gave much of a chance to, who have performed, and the bullpen and everything. It's this team that is kind of taken the start that they got back in the wild card game and through the playoffs and into the World Series and have carried it forward. I mean, that's a good story, but for some reason, you know, we want to focus on this. Though I guess it makes it easier for the writer to do that. I don't know. That's kind of unfortunate if that's how it comes down to. But I guess I get your point there. It's, you know, if that's all you see as a national guy, then, you know, how often are you going to jump in to go deeper? They should, but
right,
they don't. So
something of note that I was brought up on Twitter, I saw. It is kind of interesting. Don't know if it's related, but it is kind of interesting that, you know, the players that have been the biggest problem this year for the Royals, Brett Lawrie, Jeff Samardzija, and Josh Donaldson to this point, all have to do with the A's.
Right. And Donaldson and Samardzija, you know, were both, you know, on the team in the wild
card. Both on the team last year for the wild card. You know, Lawrie's on the team this year. So
I get that with
don't know that you know,
I get it with Samardzija because some of that was there were reports that he was yapping during the wild card game, and more just keeps being corroborated by other people. So that's one part of it. So he had some kind of beef with the Royals for whatever reason, and then, you know, you lose. I guess I get that. Donaldson, I guess, could carry over in a similar way from that team last year. I don't know about Lawrie. I think Lawrie's just an asshole.
And it's he's had problems.
He's pretty much well known by most people in the industry as just being a complete asshole. I mean, there's no way to clean that up. It's just he's an asshole.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you play well, you can get by with that. And if you don't, you get out of the league because nobody wants you. But
yeah, I think the only possible kind of parallel with that is just that Lawrie being an asshole may have kind of the A's maybe and just might have stoked the flame residual. A little bit.
Because guys like Kazmir and Reddick, who were kind of – Kazmir had that ball that hit Kane, and he's like, oh, if I was going to hit him, why would I hit him in the knee? You know, and Reddick, both guys who were on the A's last year in the wild card game. So, I mean, maybe that kind of fanned the flames a little bit and made that situation bigger than it needed to be. So I could see that part, but I don't see Donald or I don't know. I think
the biggest problem with Lawrie is from birth that he was just
he's just an asshole.
It happens. You know, what are you going to do?
Yep.
So just get by. So, yeah, it's been kind of an interesting week here in Royal Land, you know, and the. That was kind of the subtext of everything, but the plain text was they lost 3 out of 4 to the Blue Jays.
Right.
So that is not a good thing. But I mean, a couple things go differently, and you know, obviously, yeah. you know, it's baseball, and so obviously there are situations where, oh well, if this would have gone differently, you know, if
right. Sal Perez would have
struck out, then you know, maybe they don't make the World Series. But you know, there was a hit here, a hit there, a bad pitch, and you know, the Royals might have won 2 or 3 of those games. So point being, they were good games, they were close. There was only one game that I felt the Blue Jays really just handled them, and that was the first game. The other three were pretty close. One was lost in extra innings, one the Royals won, and one they kind of got away from them late, but they were in there the whole game. So
yeah, and really, that's, I mean, the Royals should have won that second game. They just uncharacteristically gave up runs, just weird bullpen management. But Wade Davis was also unavailable, so that hindered things. You know, it's, you lose 3 out of 4 and you don't want to do that, but it's not like they got blown out. And also, while they were doing that, Minnesota kept losing, and Detroit sold off 3 big names. So everyone.
To, I mean, the Blue Jays, they sold David Price.
Right.
So they're, so the Royals now have an 8.5 game lead as we speak on Tuesday, August 4th on the division, on the Twins. And I'm not even sure what it is on the Tigers right now, but it's a lot.
It's a lot.
And it could be getting a lot worse as we're talking now. The Royals are winning 5-1 in the top of the 7th. So looking like hopefully the Royals can hold off the Tigers here as Duffy's pitching well.
Yep. And they're getting into the bullpen kind of spot. So later innings.
Yep. So hopefully that'll be good. I think now we're gonna stick with a break, and then we haven't really had time on the show yet to discuss all the trades that have been made at the trade deadline. This is one of the most active trade deadlines in years. So stick with us through the break. When we come back, we're going to have a little bit more in-depth discussion about not only what the Royals got, but what other teams got as well, and kind of how it stacks up. So stick with us. We'll see you on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages.
We saw 2 or 3 different replays. It was a bang-bang play at first, yet the replays show rather conclusively that the Royals got a tremendous, gigantic break.
The Vault.
Hi, this is Ned Baudette for Kelly's Westport Inn. Summertime is here, and that means one thing. Your neighbor's cat sneaks over and craps in your garden. No, of course, I'm just joking. Summer also means my neighbor borrowing your boat trailer and driving it into Smithville Lake, or mosquitoes, or your 3-year-old drinking the air conditioner water. Haha, I guess what I'm saying here is that summer means different things to different people. And for 65 years, Kelly's Westport Inn has been a vacation for those summer problems ever since Randall Kelly poured his first frosty draft in 1947. 102 degrees and 99% humidity? Don't worry, Kelly's is air conditioned, and the drinks are as cold as ice. And when the heat breaks, Randall's rooftop is ready for you to kick back, or you can head downstairs for some of the best live music in town. Summer is different things to different people, but to everyone in Kansas City, Kelly's Westport is your summertime bar. I'm Ned Baudette for Kelly's Westport Inn. We'll leave the taps on for you.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thanks for sticking with us through that break. As I mentioned before, we're going to talk a little bit about a weird and wild trade deadline week. You know, last couple of years, it's felt like they've been really just pretty quiet. Not only the Royals, but just all of baseball, mm-hmm. especially the Royals last year, given the position they were in, they had to really make a choice. You know, some of us, myself included, were even saying, you know, they were below 500 at the point. At that point, I think that
on like July 20th or something.
Yeah, I mean, they were 48 under. And 50. Yeah. So it was one of those. We were just like, sell it, trade James Shields, Hosmer, whoever. You know, just get whatever you can. Let's rebuild this thing again. You know, it just didn't work. And you know, I was dead wrong. Couldn't be happy about it.
That's exactly when they turned it on. And
yeah, exactly. And actually, you know, I'm gonna take a little personal responsibility for the Royals turnaround. In 5 days is my 1-year wedding anniversary. So since the Royals have, since I've been married, the Royals are 165, counting the playoffs last year. I did the math.
Dang.
So. Just saying, okay? I am just saying.
So well, I have a friend who they had a kid, and that kid is – the Royals have like a 62% winning percentage since that kid was born.
There you go. So, you know? Maybe that kid will never know what this what we suffered through for a long time.
God, I would hope so. That's the case. I mean, that's what you hope, that the next generation doesn't have to suffer the same.
Yes.
There's the Kerry Robinsons and Ken Harveys and – oh, mercy.
Because it very well could have been my birth that was the death knell for the, you know, I was born in 85, they won the World Series, and they weren't back until last year. So maybe the getting married was that final step in life to reverse all the negative juju from my birth, I suppose. We'll look at it that way. I've redeemed myself by marrying an amazing woman. So,
should have done it
but
sooner.
Anyway. Yes, had I known. But anyway, the trade deadline. So yeah, been quiet last couple of years. But this year just went nuts, just going crazy. The Astros started it by making the first trade for Scott Kazmir, gave him a couple decent prospects. One that could be pretty good, a catching prospect. Can't remember his name, but people seem pretty high on him. But Mike, why don't you give kind of a rundown of – I know you've done a lot of research on this for the trades and kind of who gave up what and how they stack up against each other.
Well, yeah. I mean, after Kazmir, obviously the Royals got Johnny Cueto, and we talked about that. We talked about, you know, trading Lamb, Finnegan, and Reed. But then, you know, the Royals also went out and they got Ben Zobrist, who was – we talked a little bit about him last time. But they got Zobrist – for Sean Manaea and Aaron Brooks, which is a lot, but Zobrist is also like the perfect player for the Royals. He fits in, he covers their areas of need, and he can hit. I mean, he's perfect. He's a perfect fit. And since he's come up, I think he's driven in like 7 runs already, 3 homers in Toronto, you know, just playing great. You know, overall, the Royals got Johnny Cueto and Ben Zobrist. They gave up Lamb, Finnegan, Manaea, Brooks, Cody Reed. It's a lot, but I don't think it decimates their system. And getting the two of them together, I think, is the perfect combination, probably what their ideal trade deadline was. But other teams didn't stay quiet. Obviously, we talked about Toronto. They got David Price for some of their top prospects. They got Troy Tulowitzki by swapping Jose Reyes and some other top prospects. So those are two really big acquisitions. They also went, they got Mark Lowe, who's having a really good year out of the bullpen. Not really like a long track record of success, but he's doing well this year. The Royals still put up a couple runs off him anyway. They got Ben Revere to kind of be another outfielder for them. So the Blue Jays got pretty good, and they were in a very similar spot to where the Tigers were, but they were trending upwards, healthy team, good offense, things like that. Tigers, obviously, with Cabrera hurt, with Verlander being iffy, with Anibal Sanchez being kind of a shell of what he was last year. They were in a spot where, you know, they felt they needed to sell, that their chances of contending the rest of this year were slim. So they traded off David Price, which is big on its own. So, I mean, the Royals won't have to face David Price a few more times. They even missed him in Toronto. The Tigers traded Yoenis Cespedes, who was one of their best performers. So that makes their lineup a little less scary. And he went to the National League, so it's not like the Royals are going to run into him unless the Mets make the World Series. So that's another big thing. And Joaquin Soria got traded to the Pirates. So another team that the Royals aren't going to have to face unless it's in late October. So that makes the AL's not stronger, really. And the Tigers are weaker. And the Royals play them, county tonight, 12 more times this year. So that's a good thing. Cleveland, Jason Kipnis just went on the DL. They've traded Brandon Moss, so they're kind of fading out. Houston also got Mike Fiers from the Brewers, along with Carlos Gomez, who is one of the bigger outfield targets out there. So they've gotten a lot better, and they've already been performing well. The Rangers, who aren't that far out of a playoff spot, they went and got Cole Hamels, which was a big move. He's been on the trading block for like 3 years now, it feels like. And the Yankees went out and got Dustin Ackley, who they kind of see as kind of a bounce back guy in their stadium. So a lot of these teams, you know, New York is leading their division. Houston is now leading their division. Toronto is coming up on a play on, you know, I think they're beating the Twins tonight. So that might put them in a wild card spot. Texas isn't too far off. So these teams all got a little bit better at this stage in the season. And I mean, that's on its own just a really kind of crazy deal. Just to kind of see that much movement. And that's just teams in the AL. I mean, Mike Leake went to San Francisco and, you know, just so many deals right at the end there. Even a guy like Danny Valencia, who was having a good year for Toronto, ended up just getting waived, just, you know, picked up off waivers by the A's for nothing. So a lot of movement, a lot of stuff like that. You know, I think it puts the Royals in a position where they're still – they're going to win the division, I'm pretty sure, unless something completely crazy happens and they collapse.
I mean, unless they're the 2011 Red Sox, which I don't even know if they had – we're going to check this out. Did they ever have a lead this big, the Red Sox? I know they were, like, up 7 games with, like, 10 to play or something ridiculous.
I don't know.
But we're going to check this out right now. It's something easy we can look up. Yeah. Just because I want to give myself a little bit more assurance.
It's also different because at that point that was the Rays, and the Rays were a pretty good team. This is the Twins chasing the Royals, and that's really the only team that's going to do it. The Royals, if they go 500 the rest of the season, they're going to end up with 91 wins. You know, that's okay. You can really live with that. If the Twins were going to catch them, they'd have to go 37-20. The Twins aren't going to go 37-20. The White Sox are going to catch them. They'd have to go 41-17. The White Sox aren't going to go 41-17.
No.
So
nobody's going to go 41-17.
No, I mean it's going to be pretty darn tough for any of those teams to catch the Royals. It's just I don't see it happening unless a lot of things happen. Someone curses the Royals all of a sudden. That's about what it's going to take. As we say that, Lorenzo Cain misses and crashes into a wall. So maybe we should change the subject.
Yes.
But, I mean, the Royals are in the driver's seat. So it's not like you need to worry too much about any team chasing them. The Twins have been a team that nobody has really taken seriously as a contender all season. There's not a whole lot of reason to change that assessment. So I think it's just the Royals just have to take care of business and play what's statistically one of the easier schedules the rest of the way. And so that's pretty much where it puts them. But by getting Cueto and Zobrist, you know, they really close two of the biggest holes on the roster and set themselves up for, you know, two really good performers in the postseason. So, you know, a big win, I think, for the Royals in the trade deadline. I think Toronto and Houston definitely won, and I don't really want to face either one of them at all. So I'm still deciding which team I'd rather face between those two if it came down to it, and I'm not 100% sure yet.
For my money, Houston scares me more. You know, I think Toronto, their offense is just so nasty, and it's definitely good. But, you know, I think at some point with – because in there was a comment that I think it was Donaldson made, you know, like, we just took 3 out of 4 from what some people call the best team in the American League, you know. It's like, yeah, people who can read.
Right, you're in third place in your division.
You are 54-52, and the Royals are 62-42. So there's quite a bit of a difference there. My kind of retort to that is, well, October baseball is quite different than July, August baseball.
You can leverage things which, a lot differently.
Yeah, which we learned last year, and which is why the Royals had so much success. So, you know, the lineup of the Blue Jays, I think, can be a little bit more easily managed. Not that it's not easy by any means, right, but you can manage it to more success in October if you are in – like a lot of the same situations that the Royals had in this 4-game series would have been handled differently if it was playoff baseball.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever that means for a potential series, you know, it remains to be seen. But regardless, of that, you know, that makes me feel a little bit more confident. But I don't know that anything makes me feel, you know, I'm not scared of the Houston Astros. But if you told me to pick a team that scares me the most, it's the Astros. And I don't know that, because I don't see, they're kind of like the Royals. They're just like, they seem to just kind of do their thing, and they kind of beat you their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to combat that sometimes. And the Royals could do everything right and still wind up on the losing end. Whereas I think the Blue Jays are a little bit more susceptible to where if you do everything right, then they're not going to have much for you.
Yeah.
That's just
and,
me.
And if the Blue Jays have one bad week, they're sunk. They're done. Because Houston has better pitching and a much better bullpen. And in the playoffs, that's what the Royals' blueprint was okay, if we need to go with these guys, you know, every single time, we're going to go and do it. And they really did. So the Astros just have that kind of stuff. Plus, they have Cashmere now. They have Dallas Keuchel. They have Lance McCullers, who's been pretty good most of the year. So, and Fires, you know, that's a quality pitching staff. Whereas Toronto has guys like Marco Estrada, who, you know, he's okay, but, you know, if you faced him a couple times, you're not too worried about him. They've got, you know, Drew Hutchison, who's not really that scary. Mark Burley's off and on. Ari Dickey's been off and on. So I'm not, I don't know. I still
I
really want to be against Toronto because it seems like they put it up so much in a hurry. But there was also a thing I saw in Fangraphs, or I think it was Fangraphs, talking about how there's such a right-handed heavy lineup that if you have a team or a bullpen that has a lot of right-handed relievers and power relievers, you may be able to neutralize those guys because you've got the platoon advantage through most of the lineup.
Yeah.
And you don't mix it up. The Royals, I mean, obviously with
Michael,
Holland.
Tell me the Royals' four best relievers. What are they? What hand do they pitch with?
It would be the right.
They would be the right. Oh, that is right. Oh,
so,
weird.
And plus, if you have a rotation of Cueto, Volquez, Ventura, I guess, and someone else, you could say Duffy, but you know, if you could have a starting rotation of guys who are all right-handed as well. So the Royals kind of match up okay if it came down to it. Plus you've got, you know, the lefties in Cashmere and Keuchel who are just so good. You know, they're so good. The Royals just turned a great double play.
Yeah, that's what you heard me moan about. The Royals just turned an amazing double play. Great play by Escobar.
That was Infante on the on.
Was
the
that Infante? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. On the turn.
They've done this turn another time, and at the same time, it was Infante making the same play where first and third, nobody out. It's hit to Moustakas. He throws for the force at second. Infante ends up going to home because the guy broke after the throw to second. Just a great play.
Kind of watching out of the corner of my eye, so I just immediately thought it was Escobar. But Infante makes so many of those really heady plays. And we've talked about it before that, you know, as putrid as he's been offensively and defensively, he has his issues. But you know, he makes the plays that he's supposed to make, which is what we said for that.
Generally,
you know?
I mean, he's made
they all do, you know.
Right.
He made an error the other day. It happens. But there's a lot of I've kind of noticed quite a bit. And it doesn't justify him being in the lineup every day.
He's still a sinkhole.
But every once in a while, he makes like just an amazing turn on a double play, or he makes a really good heady decision right there that may save a run. You know, so
the highlight play that's going to be the highlight of the year.
Oh, with the flip
between he and Escobar and that flip, that is the most ridiculous play I've ever seen. That's like no hyperbole. That is just, I've just not seen anything like that.
Yeah.
And that's just one of those things that you just have to, you know, be aware enough to react to it. And he did it. So,
yeah. And to get back to the playoff discussion.
Yeah.
Also with the Blue Jays, you know, for me, they're 54 and 52 for a reason.
Yeah.
And they got a lot better by adding, they're 55 and 52. I apologize, 55. But, you know, they got a lot better by adding David Price and Troy Tulowitzki, but you know, how much difference do two players make when you're 5.5 games back in your own division and what, 2.5 back of the wild card? You know, you look at the Royals with Cueto and Zobrist. We've talked about the difference that those players make, and I don't, you know, it's still a, you know, how much difference can two players make argument, but when you're already,
yeah, when you're already ahead
division and 3 games up on number one seed in the playoffs, then, you know, when those two players start helping you pad that lead, then you're looking at, okay, this makes a, this could make a larger difference, but they're not, you know, two players can't help you climb a 5 game. I mean, I'm sure they can help. I shouldn't say.
Yeah.
Like that.
I mean, but it puts,
you know,
them,
you're not going
to the best position to improve the most from this point on, but they still have to make up the gap that they built,
yeah,
that they dug, you know, earlier in the season by only being a 500 team at the trading deadline.
Right. And, you know, we know from last year, obviously with the Royals, that anything can happen, but this team is built differently than Royals. And besides the fact that, you know, Toronto is, you know, just slightly above 500, they've, if they're going to make the playoffs as the wild card, they've got to hold back, or they've got to hold off, you know, Texas, LA, Baltimore, and Tampa Bay.
Yeah.
In their division even. And they got a lot of games against Baltimore and Tampa Bay the rest of the way. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. But for to get back to the initial part of the discussion, which is trade stuff, for my money, the only team that did better than the Royals is the Blue Jays, and in terms of what they got with trades. But as to what I just said,
they had more ground to make up.
Yeah,
and everything else.
You don't know that. I don't know that the I don't know. We're not sure the words I'm looking for. The betterness of their trade, for lack of a better term, don't know that that's going to be enough to make up the difference that they need. Whereas the Royals, their acquisitions are not only going to help them keep the lead that they have, but possibly grow it to make it even, you know, even more solid.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think, you know, the Royals could have done nothing and still been favored to win their division. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could have just stood pat and, you know, just let it be, but they didn't. They went and they got Cueto, who, another part of it is that means Cueto's not on another team. It means Ben Zobrist isn't improving another team. So the Royals get to do that too. So they've got, you know, 2 great acquisitions that fit their team perfectly. And they have that big lead. I mean, that's as good as you can do it. I mean, I'm extraordinarily pleased. I know some people are still concerned about trading away guys. And if you look at what Manaea did, you know, he threw like 9 strikeouts or 7 innings and didn't walk anybody in his first start in AA for Oakland. So, okay. Yeah, I get that. And Aaron Brooks won his first game for Oakland. Went like 7 1/3 and pitched well. And it's like, oh, yep, all right, I get it. But at the same time, it's like, you know, Brooks was just an organizational guy. You know, it's not that big of a deal. Manaea is, you know, a good guy. But in my mind, it was like, I assumed that if the Royals were going to get Cueto, they were going to have to give up Manaea. So to me, I'd already kind of made my peace with losing him.
Right.
And so, you know,
between one of those top guys, Manaea, Zimmer, Almonte, and Mondesi, you knew one of them was gone. Just hoped it wasn't Mondesi.
Right. And they did that. And Zimmer's pitching well in AA, and you know, Almonte has pitched pretty well in AAA. And so, you know, they're at a point now where it's like, yeah, you're probably feeling okay, you know, with the state of things. You know, if you'd have told me the start of the year, I don't know, maybe I'd have felt a little differently, but you know, I'm comfortable with it at this stage, and I think that makes the Royals a strong team in the playoffs, especially if they're going to continue to find ways to make plays and get runs across. And, you know, now they have their ace guy, and like we talked last week, that takes some pressure off other guys, and it helps the bullpen a little bit and just trickles down. And now you have Zobrist to fill in, and once Gordon comes back and he's taking live BP tomorrow, that puts him in a spot where Zobrist is going to be playing at second base once Gordon's back. So then you really only have like Rios as your worst guy in the lineup.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's not too bad. I'll live with that.
I can handle that. Yeah. And the Johnny Cueto, I mean, his first start was maybe a little rocky, but I mean, like the first inning that he pitched,
six pitches,
I was like, man, that's what a flipping ace looks like. And, you know, it ended up that he gave up three runs over six innings, but
he got into some trouble, looks,
yeah,
but he got out of it too. And he got out of it with like strikeouts, which a lot of Royals guys haven't done out of the rotation this year.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but he looks different on the mound, the way he carries himself, the way he pitches, yeah, you know, his body language. And again, you know, that's not the end all be all for anything. But at the same time, when you're an ace and you carry yourself, like he just looks different the way he goes about pitching.
Yeah, he was always in control, even when they had guys on. He was like, all right.
And that's kind of – maybe that's the part of the reason why, you know, we had the discussion about if James Shields is an ace, and I think the numbers supported that our conclusion that he wasn't quite. But, you know, maybe that's part of it too, because it – as good as James Shields was, it did look like he kind of struggled to be that good. Now, I don't really care. Yeah. You know, if you're going to be that good, then struggle all you want. But you know, maybe am I alone in that? It looked like it was a little bit harder for him than someone like a Johnny Cueto or a Clayton Kershaw or something like that. I mean,
he always ran into those spots, and we saw it in two different years with him, where in like May and June, like late May and into June, where he just had a couple starts where he didn't do well. And I think that's kind of what it was. It's like, you know, some guys who are the ace guys will run into those, but it's you know, maybe one or two starts instead of, you know, 2 weeks of starts. It's, you know, not four or five starts where, you know, you have a bad start, okay start, okay start, rough start. You know, they might have rough start, okay start, and then they go back to being really, really good. I think that's what it comes down to sometimes in the difference is that consistency throughout the year and consistency at a high level. And Shields didn't always have it. When he was good, he was really, really good. And there's a reason he's a game one type of starter, because he's as good as anybody on his good days. But, you know, it's just that little notch below that puts him in, yeah, number one guy, but not like the 10 best pitchers in baseball kind of conversation. Yeah,
which Johnny Cueto is not only is in that conversation, but I think he's pretty clearly a top 10 pitcher in baseball. And, you know, I think, and someone said it on the radio, might have been Kevin Keatsman, I'm not sure, but he, and I agree, that may go down, may end up being Cueto's worst start as a Royal. So
it's, let's hope that's entirely possible. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean,
and if it is, they're going away with it. They're, you know, mid September, they're making their playoff plans.
Yeah. And, you know, last year it was weird, 'cause I didn't really, there wasn't anybody that like scared me in the playoffs, but that came more from a place of, hey, the Royals are here. They won the wild card game. We're just having a good time. So if we lose, I don't care. So that's why it wasn't like, you know, when I was last year in the March Madness tournament, KU plays Wichita State in the second round. I was like, oh crap, that game scares the hell out of me. Right. And they lost, and you knew it was coming. There wasn't that feeling, you know, last year. And this year, I don't have the same feeling, but it's kind of similar, but it's more coming from a place of, I don't see anybody that, you know, I've talked about the Houston Astros, and that may be the closest, but I really don't see anybody that I think like, wow, the Royals don't have an answer for that. You know, we talked about how with a more liberal use of the bullpen, you can manage the Blue Jays. You know, the Yankees, if they're, you know, if you've got home field advantage in a playoff series against the Yankees, and you can kind of manage the bullpen the same way, I don't feel that they've got anything that's just impossible to overcome. You know, same deal with the Angels. You know, they took care of them last year, and they're largely the same team this year. And, you know, Baltimore, Tampa Bay, Minnesota, like there's nobody that like really strikes that fear into you. You know, and then even going into the National League, you know, the Cardinals, I mean, they're
played them pretty tight in most played them
pretty
game.
Well, and kind of like the last, seems like the Cardinals are always like this. They never have, like, I mean, they've since the loss of Albert Pujols, they don't have that, like, oh man, what are we going to do about X for the Cardinals? You know, like, yeah. they've had just, you know, good pitching, good bullpen, and solid hitting all around. And that's kind of what they do. And to their credit, they do it incredibly well, but nothing that, you know, you think that if, you know, the Royals play well, they can compete. And the Dodgers are a little scary with the 1-2 punch of Kershaw and Kiki.
If they
could pitch four times with those two pitchers in a 7-game series, oof, well, that's rough.
Like,
man.
In July, Zach Greinke was 4-0 and had like a 0.9 ERA.
Mm-hmm.
And Clayton Kershaw was still pitcher of the month.
Yeah. Like, that's flipping so nuts, man.
I mean, I don't even know. Those guys are so good. It's ridiculous. And yeah, that's a team that I would not want to face. But yeah, the Dodgers bullpen isn't great. So, I mean,
they're 2.5 games behind the Royals in terms of record. And
there's no perfect team.
No, definitely not.
But I agree that it's a different feeling. It is for me, especially, where it's like, last year was a lot like house money. Like, okay, we
exactly.
made the playoffs. Yep. That's awesome. That would have been the highlight of the year right there. Just right there. It would have sucked to have lost the wild card game, but you made it there.
Yep.
It would have sucked to have lost the ALDS, but hey, you made the playoffs.
Yeah, it's,
won
it's,
the wild card.
It's, I really wanted to win that wild card game, but especially after winning that wild card game, then it was just like gravy, man.
Just roll with it. Yeah. Like, every single step of it was like, this is awesome. How long is this going to go? And then once you're in the World Series, it's like, cool. I mean, we're here. I mean, it's still disappointing, but it's totally different than being there because, you know, we didn't expect the Royals really to be there.
Yeah.
That deep. And that changes it. Now the Royals are leading everybody in the AL. And so there are expectations that, okay, now you expect them to win the division.
Yeah.
Expect them to host every playoff series, you know, from here on out.
Yeah. And to have.
So that's where the crushing disappointment may come.
If
it's to happen.
Yeah. I mean, the only real comparison I have as a sports fan is, like, you know, you and I, Mike, are both KU fans.
Yep.
And, you know, look at 2003 comes to mind as an example.
Yeah.
Where KU made the national championship, you know, playing a team that you thought they were better than, have a good chance of winning, and it was just crushing the defeat.
Sucked.
Really crushing. And
but then you get that team that played Kentucky and beat Ohio State in the Final Four that you didn't expect anything. And
exactly.
That was a lot of fun.
I knew they got smoked by Kentucky earlier in the season. So I was like, well, they're probably going to lose this game, but whatever. You know, I didn't expect them to make the Final Four, let alone a championship. So this is fun.
It's just all about your
perspective. Exactly.
Going
and
in.
That's what the Royals were last year. It was just like, man, they're in the flipping World Series. Let's do this. But after that, and as painful as that loss was, you were just like, there was so many good vibes for that entire month that it was just impossible, no matter how much of a kick in the balls that game was, that
it was
just impossible to overcome all the good feeling. It still felt good.
The funnest sports month of my life. It was so cool.
Yeah, but if the Royals are the Angels of last year and they run away having the best record, you know, 95, 97, 100 wins and have the one seed, and they come in and get swept by the Blue Jays or by the Twins or whoever, you know, they end up playing, then that's going to be that kind of real disappointing, kind of crushing type loss. And I'm really hoping to avoid that.
Right. So the other thing is, like, just talking playoffs, like, when you look at Toronto and Houston and New York, the Royals didn't play well in any of those environments. And that's why it's like, okay, you're probably going to get the division, but you still have to get that best overall record in the league. Because I don't want to play 4 games out of 7 in New York or Houston or Toronto. Yeah. You know, I want to be in a spot where you get one of theirs, you know, in their stadium, and you win it at home.
Yeah,
I'm fine with it. I'm fine with winning a game 6 if it means they advance.
And as a side note, this is why I flippin' hate baseball playoffs. I hate it and I love it at the same time. And I think that's why baseball hasn't really changed it, because so many things like the Royals last year can happen. But at the same time, you know, if you're the Royals from last year, and you're the Royals last year weren't as good of a team as the Angels were, but They put together the right kind of baseball for 3 days, and it was over.
Yep.
And it, just like that, you know, all the work the Angels did, and, you know, it could be the Royals this year. All the work the Royals could do could just be wiped out in three quick games. And it's just like, we did this whole 162-game season, and it's over just like that.
Yeah, it
that
does.
Something that it's, yeah, that's a scary thought. But
yeah.
I hate true. That's it just it, there are a few things that I
they're back on the 1 hour full body massage.
I really need to hear a couple comments on Twitter, but I really wish I'd know what that was.
Now they're about, focused on the asterisk.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know. Only in Detroit, I suppose.
Maybe that's a sign.
Yeah, now there's a there's of the two things that I hate about baseball, as much as I love the sport. The playoffs and the reason why you were just talking about some of those teams are scary, having different park dimensions. Those are the two things that irk me the most, and they could spell doom for the Royals. But we're not going to talk about that because Royals are still number one overall seed right now.
Nothing to jinx yet.
No, thank God. But with that, I think we've exhausted our topics for the evening. So we'll end the show on that note. Thank you all very much for coming and listening. Absolutely love to have, it was such a great to see such a great turnout a few weeks ago when we had that watch party at Kelly's for the All-Star game, almost a month ago now. So love seeing all the fans, and there was the Kelly's watch party, for Johnny Cueto's first start last Friday as well. I wasn't able to make it, but I heard there was a good turnout for that. So,
yep, it wasn't too bad.
Super, super awesome to tell you guys. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you ever want to reach out to us about anything, on Twitter, I am at the Jeff Report on Twitter. Michael Engel is at Michael Engel, spelled Michael Engel. So, actually, it's E-N-G-E-L. Don't make that mistake.
Everybody does L-E all my life. But yes, used to it.
So yeah, if you ever have any questions or anything, want us to discuss anything or whatever, hit us up on Twitter.
Shoot us an email.
Hear from fans and everything. So
you can send our Twitter account for the show is KC Baseball Vault. The email address is KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com. So if you have feedback or ideas or disagree with us, hey, send us an email. Let us know.
Love a good Twitter discussion.
We'll give it a shot. We might read your email on the air, and answer your questions. So send us feedback. Send us random questions. I don't care. I mean, I'll answer random questions. I don't care.
Yeah,
bring them on.
Yep. Ask me anything. Maybe we should have a KC.
I don't think we should advertise that too much because Camler will find out.
That's true. So on that note, guys, again, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. For Michael Engel, I am Jeff Furr. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thanks for stopping by, and as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
I'm having to go rewatch and see what they say during this.
I'm going to ask on Twitter.
I just don't even know. Ridiculous.
Yeah, that's been kind of strange. Hopefully,
I never noticed that before. I wonder how long that's been there.
The massage sign?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've just never ever noticed it.
I mean, you got to think that it's a paid advertisement. Those things cycle through.
Yeah. But it's also painted directly onto the thing. It's not like a rotating board or digital or anything. It's just.
Yeah, they look like they can pull out those.
Yeah, I mean, you just pull it off and replace it like if it got torn. It was the same thing. But yeah,
but there's no the asterisk is not
explained. Right. I mean, it's understood. But at the same time. Wait a minute. I don't even see. Where's the. I don't see like a number or anything. I don't see like a phone number by it. I guess they'll have to focus on it again. Cause how do you redeem that
$29.95? Oh, I see. Okay. There's the section that has the full body massage. And then the section on the left of it is a advertisement for the spa. So they go hand in hand. But when the camera was focusing on the one section, so it's like Mary Green Spa or something. You see it now?
Yeah.
Left there?
Yeah. But
the asterisk is still not explained.
No.
But when you focus on just the 1 hour full body massage, I mean.
Oh, Detroit. Oh, boy. No wonder they're bankrupt.
Detroit. Yeah. So, funny story. When my wife and I were in San Francisco on our honeymoon, we were at this hotel, right? And the there's this district called the Tenderloin, which we saw Drugs Inc. on this district. Uh-huh. Largest open-air drug market in the country. So, we weren't in that district, but we were right outside it.
It's Amsterdam?
Basically. Seriously, that's what the way my wife was reading up on it before we went. She's like, yeah, the cops just kind of patrol around it and kind of look in and make sure everything's, you know, mostly okay. So it basically is Amsterdam. Yeah, but
that's crazy.
Anyway, so we were kind of right outside that district, but there were these just weird, there was this just like, you know, massage parlor type of thing. And it's like, you know,
there's like an actual business you walk. It's not like somebody with a, like a tent
or anything. Yeah, no, it's like a business. Like there's like a little, I mean, in San Francisco, there's no standalone buildings, you know, everything's attached. So it's just like these row of restaurants and shops and stuff. And then in one is like this massage parlor and like the neon sign is red and all the lights are red, you know, like red light district right. type of thing. And the windows are blacked out so you can't see in and everything. And we're like, man, this is strange. So we get back to the hotel and they've got Wi-Fi in there. And we're like, all right, let's look this up and let's see what this massage place is about. And we looked it up and all the reviews were literally the same. Like they were different people, but the reviews were the same. So it was, hey, this place is such a ripoff. I went at this because it also said it was open 24 hours, by the way. So, you know, if that tells
you anything, nothing makes you feel more refreshed than a 4 a.m. full body massage right. in the middle of a drug den.
Yeah. So this dude, these dudes like, yeah, man, I stopped here at 3 o'clock after a night of drinking thinking, oh, you know, a nice full body massage will be just what I need. And he's like, so this lady came in and did some weird touching on my back that wasn't even a massage for like 30 minutes and then said that she, you know, for me to take my pants off and they'd send somebody else in to finish the massage in a minute. And then I waited there for like 2 hours and nobody came in and I got up and I was all pissed off. And there were literally like five or six reviews that were exactly the same thing. that exact experience. And then they charge you up front, you know, like I don't know, $60 or whatever. Uh-huh. And so they charge you up front and then they just like make you sit there and nobody does
still gave
just
you like, a massage.
Yeah. More
theoretically.
Or less. And it was just we're like, man, this is way too hilarious. So yeah, that's what happens in San Francisco apparently.
Well, 60 is a lot more than $29.95.